Hi, this is Bill Arnold. Missed a show or need me talking to help you sleep tonight? I have several solutions to that situation. Here are the podcasts from the show. You are the best for listening and supporting Faith Radio. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with me. That'd be Bill Arnold. I am so glad that we have this time together because the next couple hours is going to be really fun. We've got Guy Talk coming up in just 60 seconds, followed by the beautiful and amazing Queens of the Roundtable. So our first hour is going to be Guy Talk, and you know how Guy Talk works. Any subject you would like us to cover, we would be more than happy to dig into whatever issue, concern, or question you might have. I've got Dr. Peter Kapsner in studio. I've got Dr. Jim Bilby, and I also have Dave Clutter making his first appearance on Guy Talk. Gentlemen, welcome.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm not a doctor.
Yeah, well, but you're Dave Clutter.
You're Dave Clutter.
Come on,
you're Dave Clutter.
You have an honorary doctorate.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
All right.
So we want you and your questions. You can give us a call, 877-933-2484, or you can also send a text to the same number, 877-933-2484. And we'll look forward to your calls and texts. We're going to take 60 seconds and get Guy Talk underway.
I'm Neil Stavem, manager of Faith Radio. May is one of my favorite months. It's a time of growth and renewal. And that's the season we're experiencing here at Faith Radio as well. Adding 107.5, our new FM frequency in Sioux Falls, represents the 17th radio signal for this ministry. Expanding our reach has been made possible by your consistent support. Because of your gifts, we've been ready to move forward when doors of opportunity have opened. Your gifts to Faith Radio mean growth and renewal as new friends hear the message of hope in Jesus for the first time, and as longtime listeners can continue to grow in their faith. Through it all, lives are being changed. And you're part of the story when you partner with us. Thanks for your investment. Consider joining us with a Team 360 gift. Your $30 a month goes a long way in strengthening and growing our ministry. Call 877-933-2484 and press 2 to make a gift or give online at myfaithradio.com.
Welcome back. We are enjoying Guy Talk in this next hour, so that means we would love to get your questions, whatever concern, issue you might have that you would like four guys to talk about. Maybe you've got a question about a relationship. Maybe you've got a parenting concern. Maybe you have something you're dealing with in your work environment that you think, how would another person other than me deal with this situation? So we're open to just about anything. I also have some theology scholars here, so we can tackle anything you've got. 877-933-2484. That's a phone call or a text. So, gentlemen, let's just get started with the softball. Is 90% of relationships just figuring out where to eat out?
I mean, that is a pretty critical dimension.
I think so, too.
Yeah, no, it is. It is.
And decides?
Well, and the problem is what if one person decides that they're sort of tired of a certain kind of genre of food and the other person is still all in for that? And, and you know, no, I don't want the Mexican food anymore. I mean, that, you know, that takes a week, two, three, you know, weeks to resolve it at certain points.
Yeah, and what's the process by which you make the decision?
Right. That's what I'm asking.
Right. So, yes. So here's the question. If one person, it's like, this is the restaurant that I've been dying for all day and I absolutely love this. And the other person is like, well, I'm willing to go there. Okay, so maybe you do that, but do you do that exact same thing 10 times in a row? Right? I mean, so that's the trick.
Yeah.
And actually, doesn't every couple have to sort of just create their own little rhythm around that?
I think so, yeah. Compromise?
Not just mutually default to pizza. I
mean, yeah, that's probably the best answer. Yeah.
You have a place to mutually depart to.
Yeah. You know? Dave, I have a feeling you can't turn water into wine, but you can turn pizza into breakfast.
I can eat it all three meals of the day. Yeah. And it can be cold, too.
Yes, I can make a 7-course meal using only my toaster.
And that's because you're Bill Arnold and
that
you can do that.
That is so true. That is so true.
Well, there's some magic involved in that. So.
Yeah. All right, we've been kicking around some questions this week, and I'd like to revisit them just because I got fresh voices in the studio. And a friend of mine, Chris, was wondering about, you know, an all-powerful, loving God. He answers prayers. He intervenes in the life of people. Yet there are real tragedies that are, they're perplexing, you know, something like the Holocaust or genocide or the death of people that come as a result of, you know, natural disasters. And I'd still like to kind of drill down on this question a little bit because I think it's a big one.
Yeah, and Jim, I don't know about you, but and we've talked about it to some extent. I don't know of a single class that I've taught since 2002 that this question didn't come up. I think if you told me what is the most pervasive and troubling faith question that people have, generally speaking, it is this question. And I would say this as well, that I haven't felt like I've ever received an entirely satisfactory answer. I think there are certain pathways that are interesting to explore, but I don't know that anybody has the silver bullet answer. I think there's more promising and less promising pathways with it. But, you know, I was in a church not too long ago and doing just a sound check and said, all right, ask me a question just to do the sound check. What's the question from the person that happened to be sitting there 15 minutes early?
Mm-hmm.
How can a loving God allow any kind of evil and suffering in the world? So,
No, you know, this is the issue, right? This is, and all of us at various times in our Christian life have struggled this. I lost my faith over this question quite a few years ago. Don't worry, I'm much better. but unquestionably, this issue is crucial. And I think as we... If I want to say, I don't know if answers is as maybe that's a little bold to call it this, but I think the first thing we have to do, and this is the case so often when we engage theological questions, we can't just dive in and try to start answering it. We have to start drawing some distinctions. We have to kind of divide the question up and try to understand the question itself better. And for me, there's a really big difference between the question, why is there any evil at all in a perfectly good God's world? And why this evil? And that's really important because I think we can actually give some sort of an answer to the first question. I'm not convinced we can give any real, clear, specific answer to the second question. So when we ask, you know, why is there any evil at all in a perfectly good God's creation? The answer, there's a variety of answers. God wants us to develop character. And if there's no difficulties in this world, we're the moral equivalent of couch potatoes. We never develop. So that's part of an answer. I think for me, the center of the answer is God wants there to be love. If he wants there to be love, that requires that there's free will because you can't coerce love. You can't force love. If love exists, it has to be chosen. But if humans have free will, and I would also add angels and eventually demons have free will, then there's going to be things in the world, at least the possibility, where that free will is used poorly. So I think we can talk around and give interesting context to the question, why is there any evil in a perfectly good God's creation? But if somebody starts telling me that they know exactly why this kid got cancer and this kid didn't, or why in a war this person was killed by a sniper bullet and that person wasn't, or why that person was sexually assaulted and this person wasn't, then they pretend to know an awful lot more than I think I have a chance of knowing. I think that when we start asking the question, why did this evil happen, we have to understand things at a literally God's eye level sort of thing. We need to see how everything fits together and is a part of God's plan. And I'm just going to submit that finite human minds are not even close to being able to understand that. So, but again, it's important to say that I think we can say some things about part of the question, why is there any evil, even if we can't say some things about another part of the question, okay, why this evil?
Yeah. You know, Stephen Curtis Chapman wrote a song a number of years ago called He is God and I am not. And this kind of falls into what you were saying, because we can't begin to understand. And I will never question God and those things that are unfair, like, my goodness, these school shootings and everything. You know, I think what comes into play for me is that, as you mentioned, that free moral agency that he's given us. And sometimes people make bad choices, horrendous, terrible choices, and good people suffer as a result. But that's what comes into question for me with that free moral agency. Why do good people have to suffer at the hands of someone that chooses evil? So that's a beautiful promise that we do have the choice to choose him, but a lot of people don't. They make the wrong choices, and good people suffer for it. So I struggle with that a little bit.
Yeah, and why, sure. And why seemingly does God intercede to stop those evil choices from happening in certain circumstances, and why wouldn't he intercede? And are we asking even the wrong question? I mean, it feels sort of random, like God is up sort of flipping a coin and saying, I will intercede and override human agency in this instance to prevent the evil. But now you lost the coin flip, so I'm going to allow it to happen. Mm. I think even those very views of God are probably what need to be questioned. But I think it's that kind of view of the coin flip God that causes so much trouble when we try to answer, Jim, as you've rightly said, why does this specific evil exist?
Yeah, and just to be clear, when I say I don't think we can make any headway on the question, why this evil, this isn't just sort of a blind appeal to faith. This is sort of a, I believe, a well-reasoned, thought-out argument. When we start thinking about who are we as human beings and what sort of things do we think we can know, we come to the conclusion, I don't think we can know these sorts of things. And there's even an entire kind of argument that philosophers have advanced called skeptical theism. It's not being skeptical about theism. It's theists that are being skeptical about our ability to answer these questions. So this isn't a sort of a blind appeal to ignorance. This is a well-reasoned philosophical argument, theological, I think even biblical argument, that points out that there are some things, like the question, why this evil, that we as humans can't know.
Yeah, it hurts. Well, I shouldn't say it hurts our testimony, but it kind of holds us back on how to answer when someone says, well, if you serve a God that can let this happen at a school or let this happen in Germany during the Holocaust, I don't want to serve that God. Mm-hmm. You can have that God because no God would let this happen. So that makes it difficult. And you got to be ready to answer those things, because if you kind of, then you lost them completely. So,
and I think actually, one of the least helpful things that we can do in those circumstances, too, is to say the kinds of things like if you suddenly lose a parent to a car accident or something, and then the explanation is, well, God must have wanted them in heaven for reasons, you know, and as if God had this central purpose that caused the suffering. I mean, yes, God does invite circumstances in which we are invited to character, as you said, and suffering can do those sorts of things, but it's a little overly simplistic to say, well, God must have chosen this person to get cancer because he wanted to teach us all something. Yeah. Those are really unhelpful ways to approach it.
Absolutely. The simplistic application of the verse, for all things work together for good, you know, my goodness.
Yeah.
And again, that's God's inspired word. So I think that's true, but for us to just think that we can just apply that in any given instance is shockingly dangerous. It's very, very unfortunate.
Mm. A God, a mind outside this world created this world.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll always be at a place of just humility going, well, I'm just me. And I'm up against God.
Yeah, the central sin of the garden in Genesis chapter 3 was the belief that they could be like God and they could decide all of what was good and evil for themselves, thus cutting God out of the equation. And I think that's what we wrestle with in this conversation so often.
Let me take a break. We'll come back more with Guy Talk. If you have an issue, question, concern, something you'd like us to banter around the table, please let us know what it is. We'd be happy to take a whack at just about anything. 877-933-2484. Just remember that any of the really hard questions won't be answered by me. Be right back. Guy Talk is underway, and the power panel is here in the studio. Dr. Peter Kapsner, Dr. Jim Bilby, and the one and only Dave Clutter. And so we're open to anything you'd like us to discuss. And I've got some comments coming in. Here's a one. With our natural challenges with pride, how have you specifically and personally dealt with reconciliation? Can you use a real life example?
Yeah, just chatting over the break about that a little bit, Jim, I thought that you had a pretty helpful way of sort of understanding even reconciliation, and that the danger might be that we jump to reconciliation too quickly. So I do think pride can get in the way because maybe we're wounded or because we just don't want to be with that person or something. But sometimes the fracture in a relationship, that it can take a while to walk through.
Yeah, we think we need to draw a distinction between forgiveness and reconciliation. I think Scripture calls us Christians to forgive And to forgive unconditionally. But that doesn't necessarily mean in certain circumstances that we immediately like jump to reconciliation and now we're all great and we're just moving on like this has never happened. I can imagine at least certain circumstances where that would be extremely unhealthy from a relational point of view to do that. So the first question is to ask, is reconciliation an appropriate step? Maybe that's the ultimate goal. We're aiming at that. But there's some things that need to happen before we do that. But if it's pride that's just getting in your way, that's stopping you from doing this, that does seem to me to be a problem. Now, as soon as I say that, I also probably have to admit that I actually have a current situation that is sort of complicated, that I'm pretty sure pride is getting in the way of me doing and saying what needs to be said. So, you know, listen to what I say, now what I do, perhaps, here. So just acknowledge these things are difficult. But if it's just pride.
Yeah.
That is getting in the way, I think probably we're called to set that aside.
Yeah, I think guys, it's a guy, man-woman thing where the guy says, and heaven forbid we ever say this to a woman, just get over it and let's move on. It's not that easy, but it goes deeper in most cases. But guys, maybe it is pride that gets in the way and says they just want to get over it, they want to fix things, they want to do it quick. But for a woman, it goes deeper. And we have to be sensitive to that, but it's something you can't rush. You can't, like you say, let's just say forgive, or I forgive you, or you forgive me, and let's move on. It's just not that easy sometimes. Sometimes it is. Sometimes all it takes is I'm sorry, but a lot of times it goes real deep.
Yeah, I think about the case of something, you know, really sort of extreme, like abuse. You know, what would reconciliation look like in a case of a sexual or physical abuse? I mean, is that even the invitation? Is that the call? What does it mean to have a reconciled relationship in that particular situation? And so, Jim, I think your distinction of forgiveness and reconciliation is helpful in that conversation. And Dave, too, that's probably – it goes beyond just a simple I'm sorry. In fact, of course it does. But what is it even possible to be in a reconciled relationship with the perpetrator or the abuser? Those are really tricky questions for sure.
What do you guys think about when someone comes to you and they've been reading a book that you kind of think, that's probably not a well-written book about Christianity as one of our listeners said, reading this book and this author is attacking the Christian faith. Lots of, you know, the subtle comments are really bothering him. He says the Old Testament is documented, but the New Testament, because it wasn't written until long after Christ was, has been embellished and twisted, and some parts are made up. And, you know, I want to say my first thought is you're not reading a good book.
Yeah, but can you know, do you get an audience from that person if you try to say that to them, if they're sort of enthusiastic about the book, if they've really been moved or shaped by that book, to try to suggest that that book might not be a helpful place in which to engage? I don't know that you would have an audience in that situation for that person. Mm-hmm. So that's a hard thing to know what to do in that moment with a person who's being deeply impacted by something like that.
The question the listener has is, are there indisputable facts of Christ's supernatural nature?
Indisputable?
Yes.
What do we mean by indisputable, right?
I don't know.
Name a fact.
I'm just the host reading the question. back off, Bilby.
I expect you to answer this question. Think about that for a second. What exactly is – how do we come up with indisputable facts, right? I don't know about you, but I don't think there's any fact out there that I can't dispute. Right? I mean, are we seated right now? Well, not if we're in the Matrix, right? I mean, if somebody's really motivated, they can dispute anything and everything, right? So to have a standard that if for Christians to believe it has to be an indisputable fact, or for anybody to believe it, that's a completely unreasonable standard. So what I want to do in the first place, I want to question the sort of the premise, the assumption of the question. I want to rewind that just a little bit. And I want to say, okay, maybe there's not facts out there about Jesus' supernatural nature that nobody can dispute. But I do think there are facts that a person with an open mind, a person that is whose heart is open to the idea of not just believing in God, but bowing a knee to God, that there are facts out there that can be interesting, maybe even persuasive. Right. But if we want to try to elevate this level of absolute proof where nobody that nothing can be disputed. No, of course not.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't believe anything if that's a standard we're going to set.
I mean, there are some wacky Christians out there. They're writing some wacky books.
Mm-hmm.
And
I agree.
In many cases, it just does not line up with the word whatsoever. And of course, people that question the word, then how do you say, well, if they follow the rule, I question the word too. So who are we supposed to believe here? I guess you bring yourself into it and say, this is how God has worked in my life. So I don't agree with that because I've seen how he's worked in my life and it does line up with God's word. So I don't know. There again, how much do you want to argue with people? You're not going to change their minds. They're not going to change your mind in some cases.
Yeah. Should we rate Dave right now as a first-time guest?
Yeah, I mean, that honorary doctorate really it seems to be coming through.
It's up there, isn't it?
I'd say like at least minimum of 9. I mean, Jim and I have historically
well,
been at a 7.
There's an honorary master's at least at work here.
Yeah.
Definitely
yeah.
a master's.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, you guys are nice.
All right, I'm someone who's struggled with doubt, unbelief a lot over the last few years, and I have two categories I tend to put my doubts in. Intellectual doubt, whether historical evidence, philosophical reasoning, etc., and experiential doubt, examining my own heart and life and comparing it with what the Word says and seeing a large disconnect. I'm able to work through intellectual doubts to some extent, but deeply struggle with experiential doubt, the pain, confusion, feelings of rejection by God and feelings of separation from God. How do I love and follow God in the midst of those, and how do I work through those?
I want to defer to the doctors.
Your master's degree ain't going to cut it right now.
Not right now. No.
Your fake master's degree isn't going
right,
to cut
right.
it.
Yeah, we're going to strip that honorary
doctors?
Title just now. I think as to the intellectual doubt piece of it, and I know he's speaking more towards that sort of experiential doubt, but I think what's comforting to me is that the Bible and the very invitations within the biblical text is not that we live a life absent of intellectual doubt. It is that there is a persistence of faith in the midst of the doubt. And so even as a 48-year-old now who has been a follower of Jesus for 43 years, I still doubt some of the things that I believe and wonder. And yet in the Bible, the gift of faith is something that persists of the soul, that is a gift provided by God when we bend our knee, that carries us through this life within the framework of our doubt. And so I think, unfortunately, and Jim, you touched on a little bit in the indisputable fact part, I think some people are waiting to bend their knee until they get an indisputable fact, and it's why it doesn't happen at that level, because that's not the invitation to begin with. The invitation is to bend your knee, and when you do, there is a pervasive gift of faith that grows stronger throughout the course of a lifetime that somehow can supersede the doubt that we understandably have. Now, when it comes to your experiential doubt, that's a different deal. Does God really love me? Am I really worth it? Those kinds of questions usually require something different.
Yeah, and to look at those, the questions of experiential doubt, I've certainly been there during a time in my life where I had kind of a very serious faith crisis. For me, one of the key things that I realized when I had this sense of, does God really, really even love me? I had to ask myself, what sort of standard am I holding myself to? And what I realized in various ways is that I had a picture of what a real Christian looks like. And a real Christian is you get up at 7 in the morning and you have this amazing quiet time Bible study and you feel God in your heart somehow. And you pray for hours during the day and you're moved emotionally by praise music and all these sorts of things. And I'm like, well, I kind of am a terrible Christian by that light. And what I really realized is that I was holding myself to a standard that wasn't reasonable given who I was and how God has created me. And so the person, I would just suggest that they start maybe looking less to how other people are good Christians and how they might, look more to how they might be a good Christian.
Okay, we're going to take a 90-second break. When we come back, lots more of Guy Talk. Let us know what questions, concerns, issues you'd like us to discuss. We're wide open, 877-933-2484. You can call and talk to us if you dare, or else you can just send us a text from Command Central. We'll be back in 90 seconds.
Roams around with sticks and stones, passing out his moans and groans. Devil ain't no lazy bones, he works 24 hours a day.
We're back to Guy Talk, and we love it. No, awfully nice to be having this time. We'd be talking about anything you have on your mind, any issue you have, any concern, any perspective that you would like us guys to give. We'd do our very best. And I'm always surprised at the questions that come in, and I'm always delighted that listeners have things for us to chew on. Here's one. First of all, before we get to this question, Jim, during the break, you brought up the word allegiance, and I just kind of lit up. Talk about that.
Yeah, so the underlying question of faith, the New Testament word for faith is pistis, and we've sort of struggled. How do we translate this? What's our our English word that gets a good idea of what this thing called faith is. And a lot of times we go with trust, you know, and that does part of it. But, you know, trust, you know, like I'm trusting this chair and I trust, you know, my friend. There's all sorts of layers of questions there that I think maybe it doesn't quite do it. So there's, I think, a better concept to articulate this idea of faith, and that is allegiance. That I may have doubts about various aspects of Christianity. I have these questions that are unanswered. But in the final analysis, am I or am I not going to walk the path? So a person who has faith is a person that omits their questions and doubts. You know, there's things that they wish they knew, but they don't know. They still continue to walk that path. And that, I think, is it's the most helpful way of describing the concept of faith that I have read.
I love it.
Yeah, and you and I chatted last week, Bill, a little bit just about, I love that passage in Matthew where the risen Lord appears on the hillside and surrounded by 500 people. And Matthew writes about that experience and saying they all worshiped and some doubted.
Mm-hmm.
And it just was sort of this, we were talking indisputable before the break. I mean, how much more indisputable do you need than a risen Lord standing in front of you? And even in the midst of that, there are these whispers of doubt that take shape and take place. And so I think we're setting ourselves up for failure if we assume that we will bend our knee as soon as we eliminate all doubt in our life. The question is to what will you give allegiance in the midst of the doubt?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where that gift of faith comes.
Great. Here's another question. If I was given free will as a human, is it a human right to sin?
So the interesting thing is if you're given free will that you can do whatever you want with it,
mm-hmm.
No, of course not, right? So I was given a car. Does that mean I can mow down people, you know, pedestrians by the side of the road? Of course not, right? Mm-hmm. So actually, I would say with great, great, amazing gifts come great responsibility, right? So there's very reasonable expectations when a person is given a gift and has an opportunity that they would use that well. Mm. And so what God has done when he has created us and given us the abilities that he has given us, including, I would argue, the capacity to choose, that he expects us to choose wisely. So it is your ability to sin. It is not your right to sin, not in any meaningful sense.
Mm. I like it.
Yeah, certainly there is that free will aspect, isn't there? That God's sovereignty, however we understand that, does not extend to override our ability to choose against God. And so, sin is not necessarily a right. I would agree with that, but it is something that we are responsible for. And I know that there are some people that will take some really hyper arguments that will say God is ultimately responsible for our sin because God is sovereign over all things. And I think we have to think about a different way in which God is sovereign, besides the fact that we are sinning because of his sovereignty.
God is responsible for our sin in the sense that he gave us the capacity to choose sin.
Right.
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 So if I give my car to somebody and they use that car to kill somebody else, you could say, well, that is at one level my responsibility, but the more interesting question about moral responsibility there, I think, of course, attaches to the person who chose to use the car in the way that it shouldn't have been used.
Of course.
Right?
Yep.
All right, another question. I've been married for 28 years, and my wife refuses to forgive anything. She always scowls when she's around me, but when she's around others, she's happy. She's constantly attacking me for things from how I chew my food to how I interact with our children. Please help. She refuses to pray because all of the horrible things God has allowed to happen in her life.
Wow. Well, I don't know about you, Jim, but without the two of them in front of us, I see you backing away from the microphone. I think it's a very, that's a very understandable. I can hear the heart cry in that question.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
You know, but I would hesitate, and I'm not trying to just bail out, but I would hesitate absent of being in the presence of both of them and having a chance to observe over a period of time and to have some conversations and to pry and poke and prod into the relationship a bit. I don't think that from this position in a radio station, not knowing the situation very well, that I would hesitate to say anything for fear that it would cause harm
right.
in the situation.
Yeah, that I don't want to touch that with a 100-foot pole, right? And the reason is not because it's not an important question. It's such a powerful, huge, important question. But, you know, my wife is a therapist. That's the sort of question that I think she would take months to work through with mm-hmm. a person, with a couple, given the tiny little bit that we know, I'm not sure I can say anything even sensible other than to acknowledge that that's a really serious issue.
Yeah.
And that I think the person should take that really, really seriously and shouldn't just pretend that, oh, this will be great. We can just keep going in this direction. I think there's something needs mm-hmm. to happen there.
28 years is a long time to be suffering under this situation.
It is.
And not have resolve or not have growth.
Yeah, and I think what I appreciate about the question is in the vulnerability of it is I think in cracking that open, I would be surprised if there aren't other people listening right now that could also identify with at least some sort of similar pathway of reality in their married relationship. I think that there's a lot more hurting marriages out there than what we see outside looking in. And so I think, Jim, to your point, to get in somewhere with a trusted Christian therapist to begin to work through those issues, they are not insurmountable, but they do resist an easy one silver bullet answer.
Can I actually even just add a little commercial here?
Sure.
We have this stigma surrounding therapy
yeah.
that is so unhelpful. And we sort of think of, well, if we have, if we have marital problems that are so serious for a therapist, you know, what's wrong with us? We just need to trust God and, and move on or something like this. We also need to think of therapy less like, on a car, my engine is broken down, I need to rebuild the engine. And think of therapy more along the lines of, I need to change the oil, right?
So, why didn't you do scheduled maintenance?
Right.
You bonehead, then your engine wouldn't fall apart.
Exactly. Yeah. And so therapy should be understood, hopefully, more along the lines of scheduled maintenance, where you are checking in on issues and checking, are we still communicating effectively? Or we're not communicating effectively here. Why is that? And, after 28 years, if you don't address those issues in year one, in year three, in year five, after 28 years, some of these issues become so difficult to get to the bottom of. And so my encouragement is that people would see therapy not as a scary thing and not as something that only happens after disaster strikes, but as more of scheduled maintenance.
Yeah. 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 Awesome. All right. Here's a fastball coming in at 104 miles per hour. A UN report says that nature's decline is unprecedented and transformative changes are needed. Should and can Christians lead this transformative change, or doesn't it matter because this is part of God's plan and he'll take care of it?
Well, it's a new conversation. I mean, you and I, Jim, have both taught ethics for the better part of 20 years, and I will say that in my ethics syllabus from 15 years ago, climate change, global sustainability, genetically modified food, those were at best tangential, sort of on the periphery issues that we would address, maybe not at all in class, but it has come to the forefront, and I have seen recently that the National Association of Evangelicals has begun to incorporate it in its language in terms of the challenges moving forward. So it's becoming, the question itself is becoming more mainstream in evangelicalism. And I think some of the theological wondering is, who are we responsible for? Because if there is climate change activity happening in some of the first world populations like China and the United States that are contributing to that, that pollution, that climate change reality, the greenhouse gases don't get checked at a national border. They do float themselves around the world, and there are people in Africa and in Asia that are disproportionately affected by them because they don't have the technology, the finances to deal with the impact of it. So setting aside the question, is it happening? Is it man-made? Those are all fairly controversial questions, obviously. It's something we absolutely are going to have to pay attention to in the future because of the fact that climate change realities don't respect international boundaries. And so my activity, if it is contributing to it, doesn't just impact a few people around me. It can impact globally. And I think that's what evangelicals are wrestling with right now, is wondering about what is happening. And to the extent that we identify something is happening, what do we do about it globally?
Yeah. Yeah. So first, let's deal with the idea that, well, this is all God's will anyway. Well, if that was true, then, well, evil's happening in the world. No reason for us to try to fight evil and oppression in the world because it's all God's will. Of course, that doesn't work, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really important for us to acknowledge that the first job that God gave humanity was to care for creation,
right,
to, have dominion over. It makes it sound like, oh, you can do whatever you want with it. No, have dominion. We're called humans to have dominion over creation, like I have over my children, to care and to protect. So obviously, if we're doing something that as human beings that we think has a chance of damaging nature and damaging the earth in meaningful ways, that's something we have to take very seriously as Christians. Now, there's all sorts of debates about what is okay and what isn't okay. But I think on the chance that what we are doing with how we're using technology, with how we're using fossil fuels, is having a very serious impact on creation, then yes, to answer your question, Bill, we as Christians need to be out in front of that. And my opinion is that global warming is a reality, and that that at least portions of it are man-made, and there are things that we can and should do to address it.
Mm-hmm. When you think of children who are before the age of accountability, that they don't have full capacity to understand, right? They have grown up in a Christian family. They've maybe been told what to believe, and they've maybe said words. At what point would they have to say, okay, I said stuff as a kid, but now I'm an adult, so now I get to say it and mean it? Is that something that's...
Yeah, within the realm of theological history, my understanding is it was right around the 16th century that the concept age of accountability came into play, and it was usually around the age of six at that point. But regardless of that, regardless of age, I don't know of a student that I've had, Jim, over the years that wouldn't articulate that they had to make some decisions themselves if they grew up in a Christian home, that growing up in the Christian home was a helpful sort of bathing of a Christian-centered reality around them. But at some point, I think it's beholden to every individual to say, yes, I will follow Jesus, no turning back. And that can happen 6, 7, 8, 9. It can happen really early in life. You don't have to understand all the doctrine in order to say yes to following Jesus.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I talk about this issue with my students, I go, well, when is the age of accountability? It's an interesting question, right? And I'm like, you know, I think you can make an interesting case that maybe at age 24. That's when kids actually get their prefrontal cortex. You know, the frontal lobe is fully formed. Now, I mean, that's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. The idea that there's a time or an age that people now we can actually get it and understand it, that's probably sort of silly. But we have a pretty clear sense that little babies can't understand some of those realities, and that older children, teenagers, certainly adults, can, and at some point in there, we need to usher them toward understanding these things for themselves. And crucial in that respect is to try to get them to ask questions and to deal with realities on their own. Yeah. So we need to move them out of a kind of indoctrination, you need to believe this, to helping them become good askers of questions themselves. And we sometimes get afraid that, oh no, if they ask this question, they're not going to give the right answer. But increasingly, we need to help them ask their own questions.
Awesome. Let me take a break. You're listening to Guide Talk. And if you would like us to wrestle with a question, let us know what it is. We'll tackle just about anything. 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. Be right back. Welcome back to the show. We got lots to cover and very little time left. The big hand is on 47. So let's see. Carry the 1, 13. We have 13 minutes left, so let's get going. All right. There's a stereotype that guys can't say I'm sorry. Is that, if that is playing out in a relationship, what would a good way to address it?
There was a sitcom where the husband was trying to say I'm sorry to the wife, he would go, I'm
Was that the Fonz?
That was fine.
That's for the Fonz.
Really. That's right. Fonz couldn't say I'm sorry. Yep. That's right.
That was the Fonz.
That's exactly who it was.
Yeah.
So
I don't know what you guys find. That feels like a stereotype that doesn't hold up to any kind of observation. Maybe there are a lot of guys out there that never say they're sorry. I don't know who they are. I don't have any friends in my life that aren't able to say they're sorry. Mm.
Can you fix issues in relationships, problems, if he just doesn't say sorry? Can you fix it if you don't hear sorry? Maybe that's what you need to hear, sorry.
Yeah, I think being willing to say you're sorry is pretty crucial to any relationship. and I actually also do think that's a little bit of a stereotype. Yeah. I think being reticent to say you're sorry is a human problem, not necessarily just a guy problem. Now, maybe there are aspects of kind of toxic masculinity, I'm so tough, that maybe it makes it more likely that you would have a hard time saying you're sorry. But it does seem to me to be like a human problem. But it's a real problem.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. Let me go to a question, Jim. I think I'm going to look in your direction as I ask this, because I think you just got done writing a book on this that includes this topic where a young person maybe grew up in a very unbelievably atheistic, dysfunctional family, got involved in drugs, got involved in premarital sex, and was killed by a drug dealer at 16. Come on. How does a loving God handle this situation?
Yeah, so difficult, right? I mean, we were just talking about, you know, infants and the age of accountability. And the reason why we sort of think that infants are a real problem is because a six-month-old baby can't understand gospel-related issues. There's another category of people that would be cognitively disabled, that they are intellectually disabled, and by virtue of that, they can't understand gospel-related issues. I think an interesting sort of spin on your case is to see these people, people whose life has been nothing but pain and difficulty and have been rejected by people that should have loved them and have been abused by people who should have loved them, to see them as being trust disabled, that their capacity to trust people has been disabled. And I wrote a book on the idea of salvation, and I used a case study called, and I called this person Misha. And their Misha's life was so terrible that she wrestled with, should I commit suicide or should I continue to live? And she says, I'm going to continue to live. But she masks her pain with alcohol and drugs, and she doesn't trust anybody. So how does the gospel reach a person like Misha? How do we crack through that? And I mean, I think more than anything else, crucially, we as Christians, this calls us to make sure we're not creating more Mishas out there, that we need to be so careful with how we treat people and not do things to drive people farther from the gospel. But I actually do think that maybe somebody like Misha is only somebody that God can reach, and that God can connect with Misha in a way that perhaps we can't.
So are you saying, to a degree, maybe I'm misreading a little bit, is there a place in heaven for Misha? Can God, and we're not God, so we don't know what he's thinking or what his plan is, but can he say, because of the adverse conditions she grew up in, there was no hope, there was no way to get to her, will he say, come home? Because you had no other choice. You didn't know about me, so yeah. I'm having mercy on you.
Yeah, because, Jim, you describe a phrase called post-mortem opportunity, and I think a lot of Christians live with the idea that as soon as you breathe your last in this life, that you are permanently now in a place called heaven, permanently now in a place called hell, and that is certainly one view. But there are many other views that I think are even more consistent with early church kinds of views. And I would love for you to say more about this post-mortem opportunity.
Yeah, and I'd like to be really clear here that this is one view amongst many and probably viewed by some to be a little bit on the edge. So just full disclosure. But I think, could God have a place in heaven for Misha, for a person who's had gone through this experience? I think maybe, but I want to be really careful. I'm saying we're speculating here. I'm relying on God's grace and love, and that maybe he has plans that I am unaware of. And that needs to be really, really crucial. But when I say that, it's really important that we don't water down salvation. We're like, well, you've had some difficulties, so we're just going to bypass the needing to bow a knee to Jesus thing. Mm-hmm. So whatever we're talking about, nobody is in heaven without bowing their knee to Jesus Christ. But what we don't know is what might God do either in this life or in the next to make it possible for there to be healing that somebody might experience that would give somebody like this, somebody like Misha, a genuine opportunity. Yeah. And on this, I don't have enough to say that this will happen, but I do have enough to say I hope it happens.
Yeah, amen to that. I'm glad he's making the decision and not me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's way beyond my pay grade to speak too much on this.
Right.
I appreciate that. All right, we've got a caller. Mark is calling in from St. Paul, Minnesota. Mark, we're so glad you called. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Hey, I appreciate
Step
your
into
time,
this cobra man. Pit.
Yeah, I appreciate your comment of not knowing the will of God. They used to know the will of God. Anciently we had, Moses knew the will of God. There's got to be somebody that does know the will of God. That's just an aside. My question for you was, you were talking about accountability and babies don't know. So the logical thing would be, what do you think about baptizing babies?
Yeah, thanks for the call.
Thanks,
on that.
Mark.
Certainly infant baptism began right around the 4th century, 5th century, with St. Augustine, when he suggested the sort of the initial idea of original sin, that what's truest and deepest about us is a sinful soul, that absent of some sort of intervention, that we are destined for hell. And in his mind, that intervention was infant baptism, would sort of wash away that stain. And that view persisted for the better part of about 1,500 years, so much so that my grandparents growing up, my dad growing up in my grandparents' home, a Catholic community in central Minnesota, three of the children out of the 12 that were born to my grandmother died before they had a chance to be baptized. And the church said that they had to be baptized outside of the church cemetery. So they were outside of the walls of the church because they were destined for hell. And it was 1960 in Vatican II when the Pope at that time actually changed the historic language after these 1,500 years and said that infants that are born and die in an unbaptized state are now left in the hands of God, as opposed to a certainty of eternal hell. And people literally began to dig up the graves of their loved ones that hadn't been baptized and reburied them in the cemetery. So, I mean, Jim, you would obviously know quite a bit about sort of views of baptism as well. But I find it very interesting that within the last 60 years of 2,000 years of Christian history, we've seen a very seismic shift when it comes to some understandings of infant baptism.
Yeah, there certainly has been. One of the fascinating things about the concept of infant baptism is if you push really hard, I mean, there are actually Roman Catholics that want to connect this idea of infant baptism, but there are also Protestants, Lutherans. Mm-hmm. If you really push hard on them, you're saying, really, that infant baptism saves you? That's just it by itself?
Right.
That they'll go, well, no, and they'll want to hedge on that. And they'll say, well, no, there needs to be confirmation and there needs to be faith and response on that, those sorts of things. But then we sort of have this idea that if we just baptize a baby, then they're just fine somehow.
Yeah.
And I'm not 100% sure that's the case.
Yeah, it's a little ritualistic. It's kind of like a magic act of some kind on some different levels.
You know?
And certainly in the early church, prior to Augustine, baptism, confirmation, communion was all one ritual done usually at Easter Vigil. And it was all in one part of the process, that you would be baptized and the waters come up out of the waters, confirmed with the Spirit as part of the new first fruits of God, and then invited to the table of communion with the rest of the saints. That's a very different view in practice than what we tend to now when we split apart these different rituals.
Yeah, and I think it's important to acknowledge, to say this is not to downplay the importance of some sort of rite with babies that are born. And I actually think that can be something that we see as God's meaningful action.
Yeah.
You know, God in one side, the family and the church family kind of surrounding this child and seeking to draw this child into faith.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there can be a really meaningful moment there. But to see that as just, well, now that kid's saved, and now they're good, I think doesn't work theologically or biblically.
Yeah, it doesn't. I do like the practice of child dedication as well. We're actually traveling to Scotland next week just simply because our friends over there are dedicating their second child, and we can't wait as members of the community of faith to participate in the dedication of this child. Is really a delightful experience.
It's been great having Guy Talk. Thank you so much, Dr. Jim Bilby, Dr. Peter Capster, and Dave Clutter. Thank you so much for coming in as participants of the show today. You'll each receive the entire box set of Ernest Goes to Camp movies. So thank you so much.
Something you've always wanted.
Jim, you got excited all of a sudden.
Oh, my goodness. I know what I'm doing this weekend.
Capture and Clutter laugh, and your eyes lit up.
I told you it was worth it to come on this show, Jim.
Yeah, well, I had my doubts.
Yeah. Thanks for all the great questions. Thanks for the call, and thanks for all the great texts. You've given us a lot to chew on and think about. That wraps up hour one. Guess what? Coming up in hour two, the beautiful and amazing queens of the roundtable. It's basically girl talk. So that's all coming up in the next hour. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.